Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. Our trading relations with both Europe and with China have taken center stage. In the case of China, President Trump has decided to impose billions of dollars of tariffs on Chinese goods. China is now considering retaliatory moves. When it comes to Europe, President Trump and European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker first clashed and then they agreed to work toward lowering barriers to commerce. Is President Trump simply solving problems of his own making, or is this part of a smart negotiating strategy that will ultimately benefit American consumers, producers, and farmers? In short, can trade wars be won? This program is one of a three-part series on U.S. leadership in global affairs. From multilateral agreements on trade, climate, and international security, U.S. retrenchment creates a gap that others may choose to fill. Offering an assessment is Gillian Tett. She's U.S. Managing Editor for the Financial Times. She is joined by Tyler Cowen, Chair of Economics at George Mason University. Moderating this program is my co-host, Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to my co-host, Ray Suarez.
Maybe you were only dimly aware of the World Trade Organization, or the initials WTO. Maybe your eyes glazed over when you heard the words Uruguay Round on a newscast. Maybe you live in a part of the United States where you're not even really that sure that NAFTA changed your life very much. No matter, we are in different territory now, after decades of a hardening consensus in Washington about free trade, about tariffs, about keeping a world with goods moving openly from place to place. Maybe you saw President Trump's own Twitter account in late July when he tweeted, "Tariffs are the greatest. Either a country which has treated the United States unfairly on trade negotiates a fair deal or it gets hit with tariffs. It's as simple as that, and everybody's talking. Remember, we are the piggy bank that's being robbed. All will be great." Tyler Cowen, is the United States the piggy bank that's being robbed?
Both countries benefit from trade. So we're buying goods and services from China, from Europe, but we get something in return. And the money we send to those countries, it comes back to the United States in the form of investment. So no, we're not being robbed. And keep in mind, when we buy raw materials from other parts of the world, those are inputs for American manufacturing and American exports. So Trump just doesn't understand international trade.
Gillian Tett, is the president on to something, though, that in the rules that govern international trade, in the way that things that are made in various places actually flow between nations, the United States is getting taken advantage of a little bit?
Well, the president is correct to say that some of the trading relationships have had tariff regimes. They've had detailed aspects to the rules that govern them, which are slightly stacked against the US. But that is fairly minor compared to the bigger issue, which Tyler has just highlighted, that actually supply chains today jump across borders all over the place. American companies have big operations outside America. And to try and boil everything down to the bilateral trade deficit or assume that everything has to be manufactured inside the US or else is frankly ridiculous. And to somehow present the US as being a piggyback that's been robbed is simply a tweetable slogan for the midterms.
Even if you were going to try to move the United States toward a more, economically nationalistic posture, after all these decades of lower barriers to trade, after all these decades of developing global supply chains and distributed sourcing of both raw materials and finished product, can you do it as quickly as President Trump seems to believe you can? Tyler Cowen?
Well, I would stress that other parties here are behaving in a nationalistic manner also. So the United States made overtures to the European Union about a free trade agreement, and they were basically the ones who said no. So we're not the only villain in this story. But if you think of a China behaving quite nationalistically, the EU to a lesser version doing the same, and you then ask, well, how should the United States respond? I think somewhat counterintuitively, actually ignoring the nationalism of other countries is often the best thing, that we deal with these countries on a wide variety of issues. We need their cooperation. And just trying to outcompete them with the ingenuity of American business, rather than thinking we can win some game of arguing on Twitter or being nasty to our allies, I think we would be better to just go ahead and try to win the competition on economic terms.
Gillian Tett, the United States tried that and has been in a net deficit for manufactured goods for quite some time.
Well, the first thing to say is that just focusing on manufactured goods is completely wrong, because you need to look at services too. That's the booming part of the economy. It's where a growing number of people work, including many listeners, I'm sure. And when you add services into the picture as well, that begins to change quite significantly. Secondly, you can't just look at bilateral trade deficits. You need to look at the bigger picture of supply chains. And thirdly, the really big issue is that if you want to be optimistic about what the president's doing right now, you could say, well, he's created a shock to the system. He's forced countries around the world to start renegotiating and re-examining structures and systems that have been in place for a long time that probably do need to be re-examined, whether that's NAFTA, which definitely needs to be updated for the current era, whether it's a WTO, which has often been dysfunctional, or whether it's even something like the US-EU auto trade. So he may be using shock and awe to basically put his partners, allies, enemies back on the back foot to then try and advance his strategy. That's the optimistic interpretation. The key problem today, though, is it's simply not clear what exactly President Trump's strategy is. You know, what are his core goals right now? Is it to try and change China's system of industrial development? Is it to smash up NAFTA, to stop Mexico manufacturing as much as it is? What exactly is he trying to do with the EU? I mean, the core goals right now have not been stated in a way that is particularly coherent or rational.
Well, I think if you take the totality of his statements, he looks at any bilateral trade relationship where the United States is running a consistent deficit as a loss, as a relationship that's not working for the United States. He looks at any product line where the United States is having trouble selling externally, but a lot of imported goods are coming from elsewhere in the country as a loss. And he looks at the terms of trade with many of the countries we do business with around the world as inherently structurally unfair. And this is his response. Is he onto something, Gillian?
There are pockets where you could argue that it is good that he's forcing a wide debate. So, for example, in China, the reality is that China has been ripping off American companies by taking their IP and by forcing very onerous conditions onto things like joint ventures. So if he wants to attack China on the IP side, that makes sense. If he wants to look at things like, getting better investment deals, again, that makes sense. To be worrying endlessly about steel and aluminum is less obvious, because that's pushing up prices for domestic industry inside America right now as well. And then to be trying to do things like declaring the fact that the US is importing cars from Europe is somehow a national security threat, when the US has a big auto production business itself, does not make sense. So the problem right now is that there are some seeds of truth in there. There's some good ideas floating around. And yes, it's time to re-examine the trade relationships, but to do so in such a scattergun approach is not just confusing for many of Trump's interlocutors, it makes it hard for them to actually negotiate solutions, and it risks creating the sense of cacophony and loss of confidence that will hurt the wider economy potentially quite significantly.
Well, Tyler Cowen, there's already been counter moves from various of the places where the new Trump tariffs have been aimed, from Canada, from members of the European Union, from China. What are some of the specific industries and product lines where Americans will find that either things are going to cost more money or they're going to have more trouble selling them overseas?
Well, a wide variety of goods, say, that you would find in a Walmart come from China. There's even a chance we put tariffs on almost all of those, or at least some significant subset of them. What we're doing with steel is raising the input costs for American car exporters. So it's our export industries that are suffering. Already our agricultural sector is suffering. And as Gillian mentioned, part of the problem is there is no clear set of concessions Trump would be willing to accept. I don't think he has a detailed enough understanding of the issues. So we've made a lot of threats directed at other countries. But people don't see what the end game is or that there's any pot of gold at the end, you know, of the path. And we're just left with many things dangling and increasing uncertainty, and no one knows what will happen next. And that uncertainty is itself damaging to business investment, even domestically. And we're starting to see signs of that now.
We've done a lot of number crunching in the last couple of days at the Financial Times, and we have the results up on our website. And what this shows is there have been about, just in relation to steel tariff exemptions, you've had about 16,000 requests from American companies for exemptions for products they're importing. Now, getting all that paperwork together to make those exemption requests takes a lot of time. It's very distracting. Out of that, only a tiny proportion have actually been accepted. But when you start digging into some of the companies on the ground about what they're doing, and we spoke to one big manufacturer in South Carolina that's gone and filed 30 requests for exclusions. It's got 12 decisions so far. That still leaves a lot pending. 11 were declined. And the really bizarre thing, they can't get any explanation for, they're allowed to import specialized wire for windscreen wipers that apparently meets the grade, but steel plates for repairing broken bones, apparently that's not doesn't meet the grade. They're going to be tariffs on that. So when you dig down to the minutiae, what's actually happening inside companies right now, as they try and work out what's going on, it's incredibly time-consuming to deal with this. It's injecting a lot of uncertainty, and it's basically sapping confidence.
If I could add, I don't think Trump understands what causes trade deficits. American consumers have a quite low rate of savings. It's about 4% for households. If the people in your country spend more, you are going to run a trade deficit. If you want to undo that, it's not a question of bullying other nations, but your own citizens need to save more.
But in the short term, aren't they also, here you are talking about people not saving enough, aren't their bills going to go up when they come back from the supermarket, when they come back from the department store? Aren't they almost inevitably going to be spending more money for the things they buy?
Sure, it's counterproductive, absolutely.
So that's certainly not going to get the not going to get the savings rate up.
I mean, the joke of the industry right now is in the manufacturing sector is the only people who are going to get, you know, benefit from this and get rich, apart from a couple of tiny pockets of U.S. industries, so which will, like some of the steel sector that might sell a bit more, are the lawyers who are working through all these crazy, crazy detailed exemptions or lack of exemptions and trying to work out what does or doesn't actually qualify for an exemption.
Is it hard to figure out winners and losers when one of the only ways we understand real net effects on the ground is by looking at individual enterprises? So now, quite famously, there's the nail company in Missouri, whose inputs are now more expensive because of the tariffs on steel. And they're saying, look, we're not going to make nails in the United States anymore. We just can't do it economically. If we spend too much time looking at the solar panel installation company that employs a lot of people wiring up houses for solar and installing imported panels. And if you start making solar panels from China more expensive, the boss is going to hire fewer installers. Fewer people are going to have solar installed on their roofs. It's appealing because it helps us understand in real terms how these changes affect people's lives. But is that really the measure of whether this new trade war makes sense or not? Is that really the tool that we should use to understand whether or not the Trump approach is worthwhile? Tyler?
The more complex is the international supply chain, the harder it is to trace through the effects of particular tariffs. And yes, people should study that in a more detailed manner. But I view the whole new trade war in broader terms. It's Trump's belief that multilateralism is bad, that a lot of our alliances are bad, that NAFTA has been a wrong deal. And I think if you look at the overall program of trying to pick apart alliances, trying to pick apart a multilateral view of the world, we will be very sad we went down that path. This is not a decision separate from our entire approach to international issues, and overall a relatively open, cooperative global trading order and diplomatic order has been very good for the United States. We're the world leader in economic terms, military terms, soft power. So what is it exactly that we're messing with? I think, again, there's not really a satisfactory solution at the end of this mess.
But not all that long ago, if you walked into a department store, you could find a lot of manufactured goods made in the United States. Long, long ago, when I was an economics student in college, my professors taught me that what we wanted to do was keep high value-added goods manufactured in the United States, high skill, high complexity goods, and that it was okay to let go of things like undershirts and socks, and they would migrate from the American South to Central America and to South America and to Asia, and that was okay. Losing clothing was okay as long as we held on to computers and telecommunications equipment. But now we don't make the computers, the telephones, the televisions, the television screens, or any of those things either, along with the undershirts and the underwear and the socks.
Well, it's a much richer and more advanced world now. So you have to ask, do we want to live in a richer and more advanced world or not? And it will involve bumps and transition costs. But I think as a nation, we should decide this is in our self-interest as well.
I'd add to that actually the battleground today is not about televisions. It's not even necessarily about the manufacture of the iPhone. It's about the design of the iPhone. It's about the IP inside it. It's about AI. It's about all of the service sector jobs that go with that. And that's what America should be fighting on retaining. So yes, you know, some manufacturing is important. The reality is that even manufacturing, which Donald Trump is so keen to champion, no longer employs people the way it used to do. And what is driving this at the end of the day is jobs. And, you know, unfortunately, what even countries like China are discovering is that although a Chinese manufacturing worker is cheaper than an American worker, a robot is cheaper than a Chinese manufacturing worker too. So trying to pin your entire economic strategy on getting manufacturing jobs into the US, back into the US, is really chasing after a target that's 30 years out of date.
You say some manufacturing is important to retain, and it's very true that the design, that the R&D, that the brain capital that goes into designing an iPhone is still very much onshore in California and various other places in the country. But that's fairly small numbers of people compared to the numbers even in a more robotized manufacturing system. It's still fewer people sitting around noodling about how to design a chip versus the hundreds who are putting together, let's say, tablets.
There are plenty of sectors where there's no foreign competition, like direct retail service. The person has to be in America. Some of those jobs are going away, or the wages maybe aren't going up as fast as we would like. But it's not foreign competition that's to blame, so we need to keep this in perspective. Most of our economic wounds are self-inflicted.
Jillian, has there been a strange political realignment of the American argument over trade? When I covered the debate over NAFTA in Washington in the early 1990s, both the negotiation period under George Herbert Walker Bush and the ratification period under Bill Clinton, some of NAFTA's most ferocious opponents were Midwest, Great Lakes Democrats who worried about manufacturing jobs, who worried about union jobs, who worried about plant closures, who worried about offshoring. And now, Democrats are wringing their hands over the tariffs, opposing Donald Trump's maneuvers, and it is Donald Trump who is turning back the Ronald Reagan-led consensus over lowering barriers and freeing trade.
I think you make a very good point there, because I've spent time recently with some of the senior figures in the Democratic Party, and they point out that Donald Trump has achieved something which used to be considered almost impossible, which is essentially creating about a 70-75% support rate amongst Democrats for NAFTA. That absolutely was not the case 10 years ago. Whereas on the Republican side, you appear to have still pretty strong support amongst the rank-and-file Republicans for what Donald Trump is doing on trade. So there's been the most extraordinary sort of inversion or flipping around. And one of the most telling points that's happened in the last 6 months was on the 100th day of the president's administration, when he was supposed to be at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, but he actually went out to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, to speak to a Trump rally. The issue of currency manipulation came up, and the president actually told the crowd there, these are Trumpian supporters, he actually told the crowd there that, you know, of course I'm not going to label China as a currency manipulator because we need them to help support us for North Korea. And the crowd cheered. And certainly in the early months of his presidency, the president appeared to be able to rally support on a national security or patriotic ticket for his supporters to agree to do things which may not make economic sense or might actually economically hurt them. So the question right now is, you know, is there a point when patriotism, national security issues begin to become less important than the economic consequences of some kind of trade war, trade strategy or not? And it's going to be very interesting to see how that unfolds in the coming months.
Tyler Cowen, it is interesting that now you'll hear more Democrats speaking up for NAFTA. It's like you wouldn't miss me until you were afraid that I'd be gone. But during the ratification period, Republicans acknowledged that jobs in the United States would be lost, but insisted they were jobs that were going to go away anyway, no matter what. And at least NAFTA would create order, make eventual customers richer, open new markets for American goods, that richer Mexicans would buy more American stuff. And then later, when the United States acceded to Chinese membership in the World Trade Organization, some of the same arguments were given, that richer Chinese will buy more American goods. Has that happened?
I think NAFTA was oversold. It's had a positive effect on the American economy, but actually a very small effect. It's had bigger benefits for Mexico. That's what you would expect when a much larger economy starts trading more with a much smaller economy. As for China, keep in mind now, they're on the verge of being major innovators in drones, in biomedicine, in payment systems. So we will benefit from those innovations, just as, say, Chinese and Europeans benefit from American innovations. How did China get so quickly into the position of being on the verge of being a major innovator? It's because they had foreign trade.
And also a far-seeing policy of sending a lot of their brightest kids around the world to be educated before they had great universities to do it. They came back with a lot of wealth right between their ears, didn't they?
Sure.
So the Chinese are richer. The American consumer has made them richer, but they don't necessarily buy more American stuff, or it may just be stuff with an American name like a Buick, but the Buick is made from parts that are sourced across the world. Did the United States, Jillian, achieve any benefit?
Well, the United States has achieved benefit in two ways. One is that there has been business done by American companies in China, you know, maybe not on an entirely equally balancing way, but there has been business done. And, you know, American consumers have been buying goods which they rely on in Walmart and everywhere else, which are cheaper because they come from China. The other benefit that no one's talked about yet is that China has used the money it's made through all this economic development to buy an extraordinary amount of U.S. treasuries and U.S. government securities. And, you know, the other side of this equation that people aren't talking about, which Tyler mentioned earlier, is that the U.S. needs to borrow from overseas to keep funding its current economy. It simply is not saving enough to be able to do that itself. And China has been supplying much of that cash. And if that was to go away suddenly, and if today's trade war turns into a nasty currency war, capital war, that's possible. But if that was to go away, the Chinese support for the U.S. economy through all the bonds it keeps buying, the consequences for the U.S. could be rather nasty.
Tyler Cowen, we went through this period where we rethought what it meant to be an economic power, and more people today engineer money than engineer actual things that make things move and change. We saw a generational change from a frankly economically nationalist argument like the one that Lee Iacocca made at Chrysler when he was trying to change the company and save the company, to one that you heard from Alex Trotman at Ford, who told me in the 1990s that the idea of an American car, quote unquote, was increasingly meaningless, and that when he had to buy parts, it didn't matter to him where in the world they were made as long as they were good parts. So where are we now? Are we in Lee Iacocca's world? Certainly that Lee Iacocca world that changed, that shaped a lot of Donald Trump's thinking. Or are we in Alex Trotman's world, where you can get a transmission from Brazil and push rods from Canada and seats from Ohio and make a car?
We're in a world where most of the wealthier countries are close to having free trade with each other, and that's for the better. It is correct, and Trump is right, that China is a kind of problem case. They don't let in enough American companies. The tech companies such as Google and Facebook would be one example. The question then is, though, what do you do about that? Do you respond by applying tariffs to hundreds of billions of dollars of Chinese goods so that President Trump becomes less popular abroad? The Chinese, it's a central event in their past history of being forced to open up to foreign trade, the opium wars, the resentment of this, the desire to have more nationalism again. This is playing into the hands of the Chinese hardliners, what President Trump is doing. So I think it's counterproductive on that front. There are true injustices. American business should and could be doing better in China. But right now, our options for redressing that, especially since we want cooperation on North Korea, those are fairly limited.
Well, Tyler Cowen, one thing we were told is that the WTO was going to be the mechanism that would help us work out some of these disputes. It would be the court where these things would be hashed out. Does the dispute resolution function of the World Trade Organization not work? We're a member, China's a member, and yet these things go on.
The WTO has never been that strong. Historically, it has a pretty good record, actually, of ruling for the Americans. But for the WTO to work, countries have to buy into the premises of the system. China actually doesn't do that. We let it join the WTO nonetheless. That was a kind of exception. Looking back, I don't think it was a mistake. But we ourselves decided we're going to have a WTO where the second biggest economy in it really won't be subject to the same rules because China subsidizes its industries in roundabout tricky ways that aren't typically covered by WTO strictures. We made that decision. It was mixed. It probably was the right thing to do. And now we're unhappy with ourselves and we're kicking ourselves by basically being self-destructive in response.
Gillian Tett, same question. How come the WTO is not working in easing some of these tensions between members?
There are two reasons why the WTO is facing challenges. The first is the WTO has become a very bureaucratic, slow-moving operation, a bit like anything, which is charged with negotiating amongst a huge number of different, very powerful bodies. I mean, trying for the WTO to try and get anything done is a bit like trying to herd cats. So there's frustration, quite rightly, with the WTO. And the WTO, of course, is facing, you know, increasing competition from other regional trade groups that are negotiating their own deals, never mind the bilateral ones. But the other problem is much simpler, that Trump is not interested, President Trump is not interested in respecting international bodies that he sees as curbing the power of America. And so, frankly, even if the WTO was the most efficient, organized entity in the world, which it's not, I think at this point, President Trump would be militantly opposed to it on almost any condition. And if you look at Europe right now, it's a very interesting case study because President Trump likes to say that I'll only do bilateral trade deals. He likes bilateral trade deals. He's even said that actually, we should stop talking about NAFTA because it's a trilateral trade deal and I'm going to negotiate separately with Canada and Mexico. We don't know whether that's going to happen or not, but it's been very interesting in dealing with the European Union because, you know, at various points, President Trump has said, well, I don't want to deal with, you know, 27 countries. I want to deal with the countries one by one. And the European Commission has had to go back and say, actually, there's going to be one person representing all of the European Union. We will do a bilateral discussion if we need to between Europe and the US, but it's basically one-on-one. But trying to get President Trump to understand that there can be different structures of political action beyond simply having a nation state with one dominant head or White House has been a challenge. So there's a cultural issue here as well, which is one reason why people keep talking past each other on the trade front.
We've been hearing from Gillian Tett and Tyler Cowen on the impact of decisions made on international trade. After the break, we'll discuss what to expect going forward, how the trade war may influence domestic politics, and what the real costs may be. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Gillian Tett. She's U.S. Managing Editor for the Financial Times. She's joined by Tyler Cowen, Chair of Economics at George Mason University. Moderating the program is Ray Suarez. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program that you may have missed, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, one word. And now back to our program.
Tyler Cowen, earlier in this century, I was talking to a Secretary of the Treasury. We were having lunch, and he told me he would never advise the people of Marysville, Ohio, to buy Hondas, even though Hondas were assembled there. The engines came from elsewhere in Ohio. The steel came from next door Indiana. Would a senior American cabinet secretary say that in 2018?
Trump's cabinet and Trump, they often think and say, or maybe even do, very different things. I think it's one of the problems with our trade policy is that right now it's just not coherent. Other countries don't know what to expect from us. At a purely local level, it's fine to tell people from a particular region, well, trade is not always better for your job. Of course, that's correct. But if you think about the system as a whole, we really instead ought to be focused on what can make America more productive, more innovative, and to be strong in the sectors that will be important 20, 30 years out from now. And I see this as a wasted opportunity. The Republicans control major branches of government. There are things they could do and get through, get them passed. And for the most part, they're not doing it.
So it sounds like you wouldn't necessarily tell somebody in Marysville that it might be a good idea for them to buy a Honda either.
Well, a Honda's a great car, right? So in that sense, it's a good idea. Will it help their community? Perhaps only marginally. But I don't think you can evaluate trade on the basis of looking at every individual community and asking, does it help every person there? You're setting rules of the game for the country and the world as a whole. And there, pretty much all economists, Republican, Democrat, whatever, will tell you that free trade tends to be in the interests of a greater number of people in virtually all countries.
Well, we are told by the behavioral economists that people make conclusions based on something that mixes their economic self-interest, their personal well-being, the enhancement of their the utility of the things they buy. Gillian Tett, I think we're getting over onto your patch there with cultural anthropology. I think somebody living in Central Ohio might feel that they're doing a good thing if they, well, at least give Honda a good shot, because they know the people who work there and the people who work at the restaurant down the block serve a lot of meals to the guys coming from the plant. There are tangible effects, even though Honda is a Japanese-based company, in buying an Ohio-made vehicle.
Well, there are certainly tangible effects in recognizing that there are a large number of non-American companies in America today that are employing a huge number of people, training a lot of people. I mean, let us not forget that companies like Siemens have been at the forefront of trying to work with community colleges to train people and actually, you know, create a more sustainable economic community. And the question is, if people think there's something wrong with buying a Honda or a company that's owned by a non-American company but building and operating in America, what do they think about American companies operating overseas? I mean, do they really want to push for a world where everyone withdraws back to the U.S. if you are American? Because, again, one of the things that the President and White House really talk about is whether they want to see all the American companies coming back to America all the time and not investing overseas to take opportunities, a bunch of opportunities overseas. You know, the reality is that trade and investment has been a two-way game until now. And the president may feel that the U.S. is losing from that. Many American businesses would choose to question that. And the other big question that people aren't really looking at what point will American business start to speak out? Because certainly in the first year of the presidency, most American business leaders appear to have concluded that actually the benefits of tax cuts and deregulation and a growing economy meant it was worth their while keeping quiet on issues like immigration that made some of them uncomfortable, or the trade issues. Again, it's going to be very interesting to see if that changes or not, because one of the things that's very striking about this whole trade war is that it's been launched at a time of economic growth. So there's more resilience in the U.S. economy to absorb the hits from it. There's never a good time to have a trade war, but right now is probably the least bad time. What will happen, though, if the economy does start to slow down or if even a recession looms?
I want to stick with cars for a little bit for a couple of reasons. One is that they are one of the worldwide industries that have the most widely distributed supply chains, the most widely distributed labor forces, and widely distributed investment. And they're also something that a lot of Americans relate to, understand well, and buy. One of the more interesting wrinkles in the president's latest warpath on trade is the case of his seeming personal animus toward Germany and the case of Volkswagen. Volkswagen, which has located a lot of its production in the United States and is even, along with other German automakers like Mercedes and BMW, exporting German-badged finished vehicles to other places in the world from the United States. And it seemed, Tyler Cowen, that the president either wasn't aware of this at all or was willing to risk upsetting the apple cart on this.
The biggest exporter of cars from America is BMW, which is a German company. Keep in mind, before all this happened, in polls, support for free trade actually was rising. It's not that the voters demanded all of this to protect their jobs. It's really just Trump's ideas, which come from the past. It seems he's held them for a long time, and now he's dragging around voters who want to show they're on his side. But this is not a populist-driven, voter-driven phenomenon. It really comes from our president.
But Tyler Cowen, if these policies persist and they have the effect, you know, already, in just a matter of a few weeks, there's been effects on American industries, is this something that actually takes a longer time to fix, to repent, to heal, than it does to put in place? If these are policies that are put in place in a matter of a few months, are we actually looking at problems, arguably, that might take years to work themselves out?
Trust is very easy to break. It's very long and costly to repair. We've broken the world's trust in us on the trade issue. I think we will suffer from that for a long period of time to come.
Gillian Tett, we've been having this conversation with this great big umbrella word, trade. But would it be a good idea, as we try to understand the motivations of the president and also understand the different effects these policies might have, if we split out the United States' North American trading partners, Canada and Mexico, our European military and diplomatic allies, most of whom are in the EU, and our new economic rivals, places like China. Are there distinctions that should be made when we're trying to understand policy and understand the effects of tariffs with these different entities? Are there distinctions being made in the White House, do you get the sense?
Well, there definitely should be very big distinctions, because there's a difference between a close ally, there's a difference between a generally friendly country and an economic competitor, rival, and a country which appears to be actively hostile. And, you know, if you are going to use national security rules to try and clamp down on, say, imports of aluminium or aluminium or steel or autos, you know, it seems very odd to be complaining about imports from Canada, which has been a very long-standing close ally. It seems pretty odd to be complaining about imports from Europe, because, again, there's NATO, which is binding the US and Europe together in a military alliance. China is a different matter, because China has been a very active competitor, not necessarily outright hostile in the way that, say, Russia might be today, but it has been a very active competitor. And the problem, I think, which leaves many observers confused about what the real goals and aims are of the Trump administration, is that Trump himself, the president himself, often appears to jump from country to country to country somewhat indiscriminately, tweeting one day about Japan, one day about China, one day about Europe. And maybe that's part of a very carefully planned strategy of destabilization to keep everyone else on the back foot and feeling a bit nervous. Or maybe it's just because there is indeed a sense of confusion or uncertainty within the president's own mind or his team about, you know, what the trade issues really could or should be.
If you're just joining us, this is World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez. This program on changing American trade policy, tariffs, and President Trump's ideas around trade war is one of what will be a series of programs on the change in America's role in the world. We'll have coming episodes of the program in the coming weeks, looking at an assertive China, China moving into places in the world where you might perceive a vacuum, China looking to be a reassuring force on the world stage as the United States is perceived as less reliable or more erratic. I want to talk, Tyler Cowen, about domestic politics. We are approaching critical midterm elections. There are Republican congressmen defending seats in places where this stuff matters, where the real downstream effects will be felt sooner rather than later, whether it's soybeans or bourbon or whiskey or even foreign-owned auto plants that are exporting cars to other countries. Could this have serious unintended consequences for Donald Trump's own Republican partners?
The trade wars have already caused stock markets to decline. I think in general, no matter what the short-run polling numbers show, in American politics, you don't win big by being pessimistic and petty. You put forward a grand vision about how this country can be great again. And Trump has the slogan, "Make America Great Again." But his actual energies are being directed at criticizing our allies and threatening them. And people don't see really the bigger vision. So it's not the Republican Party of Reagan. And I think this will cost the Republican Party for a long time to come.
A Republican campaign consultant who works in Kentucky and Tennessee was advising a client who's defending a Tennessee seat. He told a reporter, "I was hoping, and many Republicans were hoping, that we would spend the whole year talking about how the president's tax reform and regulatory agenda would take off. Obviously, other events have interceded." Does the president have personal persuasive popularity, Tyler Cowen, that might be able to override this? He plans on heading through the near South and the Midwest to help some of these members of Congress who are defending tough seats. Can personal appeal, can charisma, can the same magic he pulled out of the hat in 2016 help override problems in the soybean industry?
Only with his narrow base. Trump would do much better to just take credit for the good things happening in the economy. Americans prefer winners to whiners. And right now, Trump is talking about all the different ways we're being ripped off, and he's sounding like a whiner.
Gillian Tett, on the international political stage, just recently President Trump was in the United Kingdom, and before the visit, a lot of commentators were pointing out that Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, needed a good working relationship with Donald Trump, even if it was hard to have one, because a United Kingdom leaving the European Union was going to be heavily dependent on a victory in forging a bilateral trade relationship with the United States. How does that look following the Trump visit?
Well, following the Trump visit, I think there's a new mood of rather chastened realism amongst the British establishment on the chance of striking a deal with the Americans. And that's not so much down to anything that the president himself said on during the trip, although he certainly made some comments that threw the cat amongst the pigeons in terms of saying that the US couldn't do a deal with Britain if it didn't have a clean Brexit, if you like. It was more the realization that the Americans right now are opening up trade wars and trying to renegotiate trade deals on so many fronts that there's a real sense of unpredictability and a lack of bandwidth. And people in London are really quite gloomy about whether they can actually strike a deal in a swift, effective manner with the Americans when there's so much else going on. And that's distinctly disconcerting.
Well, does that put the whole Brexit enterprise into question now in a way that it might not have been under a more predictable American government?
There are absolutely numerous reasons why the whole Brexit enterprise is under question right now. And I think that, you know, the president's comments or a chance of a trade deal with America is probably one of the less important factors that are making things uncertain. You know, the bigger issue right now is if you look across the Western world, the proportion of the vote going to populist candidates, according to calculations by Bridgewater, the big hedge fund, but the proportion of populist candidates or populist vote in the Western world has jumped up from around 5 or 6% in 2010 to about 35% in 2017. They haven't yet updated it for the recent elections. And a swing of that magnitude in terms of the explosion of populism, not just in America, but in Europe too, has only ever been seen once before in history, which is the 1930s. And that didn't end well at all. But this kind of sudden explosion of populism has made nationalist elements and protectionist elements a feature on many countries' political agendas right now. And it's making it very hard for people to talk rationally and calmly about trade, not just in America, but the UK as well.
Is this evidence that the world's consumer rank and file, the world's voting rank and file, just don't believe their own national elites anymore? They either feel that they were lied to or that promises were made that simply were not kept. Because taking the sum of what you and Tyler have been saying throughout this program, a lot of these moves are going to hurt individual consumers, individual wage earners, individual taxpayers, individual voters, but they are still rushing headlong into the arms of Duterte in the Philippines and Erdogan in Turkey, Andres Manuel López Obrador in Mexico, and on and on and on.
Well, I think there's absolutely a chance that, you know, at some point the population will get angry and redirect their anger. And to me, the issue of soybeans right now is incredibly symbolic and important. I mean, who would have thought that the humble soybean could end up being such a major geopolitical weapon? But the reality is that by targeting soybeans, China has very cleverly threatened to hit Donald Trump's base in a way that the president's going to find tough to inoculate himself against. And yes, we've seen the US unveil these massive aid packages for the American soybean farmers, and those are significant. But the question of whether that's going to remove all of the uncertainty and all the anger that's bubbling right now in the soybean world is very interesting. And I think it's going to be fascinating to see what happens in the forthcoming midterm elections. I mean, $12 billion for farmers, which is what the Americans are unveiling, sounds like a lot, but it's actually not that big when you look at the scale of potential impact on the farming sector from this trade war.
Tyler Cowen, I guess the coming months will tell us whether or not aid to farmers who are hurt by the new tariff regime is good politics or not. Is it good economics?
It's not good economics. You're taking one distortion and piling it on top of another. and you're just packing everything in, making it more complicated, harder to undo. Once people start getting a benefit, it's much harder to take it from them. So I think this will be a disaster.
So that's money that's being aggregated, collected from the various revenue sources of the United States, and of course borrowed, because the United States is going to borrow a massive amount of money to pay its obligations in 2018, and given to farmers to make up for soybeans, what, that they couldn't sell any longer on the world market because they're being undercut now?
The details are still pretty murky.
Right. So a lot of this remains to be seen. Yet, the president's approval numbers, his latest approval numbers that have come out during the summer, show that things are holding pretty steady. So Tyler Cowen, maybe people are sizing this up and they haven't been hurt too badly yet and don't hold the president responsible in any case.
I'm not sure that's true. I think in today's politics, you can't just look at aggregate approval numbers, but how many people dislike a particular president or party intensely. And I see Trump is generating more and more intense dislike. And what the Republican brand has become is not good for the party in the long run. There's talk of a possible Democratic wave in the House. In the betting markets, there's even a 20 to 30% chance the Democrats take back the Senate with very unfavorable distribution of seats. So the Republicans could very easily come to regret this whole series of moves.
Does that blow a little cool breath on the hot broth of this moment? Tyler Cowen, if in fact Republicans are punished by the voters in the fall, are people in other places around the world looking at that and saying, okay, we only have to put up with these policies that we find complicating or challenging or noxious, for another 6 months, another 8 months, another 9 months?
I'm afraid that protectionist forces are rising in many countries around the world. I mean, I would put it this way. The rise of globalization has been very rapid. And even now, each year, more people are rising out of poverty around the world than ever before. That's the single most important fact about our world. So maybe some kind of nationalist backlash is indeed inevitable. I don't like it. But I would just say if we're going to have a nationalist backlash, we need one that's a little more mature than what's on the table right now.
Gillian, Ted, in boardrooms and cabinet rooms among the United States' major trading partners around the world, is there a wait-and-see attitude? Are there some people cautioning that Trump's ability to unilaterally do these kinds of things may be tempered by the results in November?
I think some people are definitely hoping that political reality will act as a check on the president and the protectionism. But the reality is, I was in a meeting this week with a number of, you know, big Washington and Wall Street players, and the consensus around the room is that we've probably not seen populism peak yet. Because a crucial thing to understand is that we've seen this dramatic increase in populism from 5% of the vote to 35% in the Western world in the last 5-6 years, during a time when actually the global economy was growing. I mean, to see this kind of protectionism and nationalism, populism erupt in a period of economic expansion is quite striking and a big contrast to the 1930s. What's particularly scary is to think what on earth is going to happen to politics if and when the global economy goes into recession. It's possible we'll see even more populism and protectionism then.
Gillian, Ted, let me get one last question. Your best read on the next 6 to 9 months, these new tariffs on both sides, on the United States and from the United States, will really finally be percolating in, soaking into the pores of global trade. What effects do you see happening through the rest of the summer and into the fall?
My negative predictions is that we see growing economic skirmishes, shadow boxing, growing pain on the economy that simply keeps mounting as businesses become more nervous, consumers start to see the higher prices, but the White House simply digs in. The optimistic scenario is actually the sheer shock of what's happening forces a serious conversation realignment, and that actually out of this period of chaos, we'll actually see the president retreat a bit. And we may see more trade deals be struck next year or the year after. It's very striking that actually in response to President Trump taking this very belligerent approach towards Europe, Europe and Japan have just raced to cut their own trade deal at record speed. And you're seeing a number of other countries outside of America saying, actually, yes, we need to embrace a lot more trade deals, a lot more free trade. So maybe, just maybe, this is the darker side in the storm, and we'll start to see the sheer shock pave the way for a bigger realignment that could be beneficial in the long term. But I have to say that that happy scenario is not something I would predict right now.
Along the same lines, as you look at these new barriers, these new raised tariffs starting to take hold in various bilateral relationships, in specific goods like whiskey, bourbon, and soybeans, what's the near-term and medium-term effect? What are Americans going to see through the rest of the summer, into the fall, and perhaps early 2019?
Most production in this country is still domestic, and that means these trade wars will not be the end of the world. We'll see some higher prices. But most of all, over the next 6 to 9 months, we'll see a lot of mess. Our allies will doubt us more and more. And 5, 10 years in the future, when we need those allies to support us on something else, that's when we'll see the real costs of what we're doing right now. So I'm deeply worried, but not actually about the next year to come.
Well, you mentioned the possibility of rising prices. And of course, inflation is one of the things that the Federal Reserve looks at quite closely and makes its decisions about near-term interest rates around inflation. The president has been speaking loudly and aggressively about the Fed's independence and its willingness to raise interest rates. Are we headed for some sort of collision there, that inflation hastened by Trump's own policy could then not be met by the Fed because of the president's own pressure to try to keep interest rates low?
I don't think Trump is quite pressuring the Fed. I think he wants a fall guy. So if things go wrong, if he has bad luck, or if the trade wars turn out to be more costly than he had thought, he wants to be able to point his finger and say, look, they did it, not me. So he's laying the groundwork for that future blame. I don't think it's about taking away the Fed's independence.
When Donald Trump successfully won the presidency in 2016 and took office in early 2017, a lot of Republicans reassured each other that the institutional party would crowd in around the president and cool some of his more hot-tempered moves. It doesn't look like that's happened, has it?
It depends on the issue. Trade has flared up lately, but I would say let's not over-extrapolate from the very latest headlines. On many issues, Trump has remained somewhat constrained. So we'll see how this develops. Congress still has the ability to take back most of Trump's trade authority if only they decide to do so. I don't expect that to happen right now, but my hope is that over time, the threat of this will rein in President Trump.
Well, certainly a lot of members of the House and Senate in the majorities mutter about it, but they never seem to do it. And Trump's own popularity with the base may be part of the reason why.
Sure, they're afraid. Trump is the one with the direct connection to the voters. They look small in comparison.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Gillian Tett. She's U.S. Managing Editor for the Financial Times. She was joined by Tyler Cowen, Chair of Economics at George Mason University. The program was moderated by Ray Suarez. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, VMware, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.